This is episode 36 of the Reading Copes podcast. If you're a book lover who may be interested in joining our online book club, please visit our website at thereadingcove.com. For November 2013, we're discussing The Chaperone by author Laura Moriarty, and we're very excited to have her joining us for the discussion. Okay, so hi, I'm Millennia in Florida.
Hello, Millennia in Florida. I wish I were in Florida. It's freezing.
And I'm Roberta from Atlanta.
And we are excited to welcome author Laura Moriarty to our podcast to discuss her wonderful novel, The Chaperone.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, thanks for taking the time to join us. So why don't you kick us off a bit and start by telling us how you came to write this story.
Okay. I was browsing in the bookstore. And first of all, I want to say my previous novels, they've all been contemporary. Mm-hmm. And I've always really enjoyed historical fiction, but I've always been a little intimidated by it. I teach at University of Kansas, and I teach a lit course called Historical Heroines. And
we
read Gone with the Wind, which Roberta might have some knowledge of. I'm guessing just a bit. I teach Gone with the Wind, Beloved, Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Atonement, The Reader. And we have these really great discussions about them. So I just love historical fiction, but I've always been intimidated by how much research you'd have to do to get one across, you know, realistically.
Right.
But then I was just browsing in a bookstore one day, and I came across this book about flappers. Mm-hmm. And he had it, it was a nonfiction book by Joshua Zeist, just called Flapper, and he had it sectioned off, so each famous flapper got a different chapter. So, you know, the first one was on Zelda Fitzgerald, and the next one was on Clara Bow, mm-hmm. and then it got to Louise, and what he said about Louise Brooks, you know, there's that beautiful picture of her with her dark hair and dark
right.
eyes that said, you know, a lot of the other flappers sort of played the part of the bad girl or the rebel, but Louise Brooks was the real deal. Like
right.
she was the one who was truly, truly rebellious and didn't care what other people thought.
Right.
And so I started reading about her, and I learned that she came from Kansas. And I learned that she was really funny and incredibly smart, very talented, self-defeating, an alcoholic, not always very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned when she was 15 years old and already all of those things, she left for New York City in the company of a 36-year-old married housewife from Wichita acting as her chaperone.
Right.
And that's when I thought, oh, there's a novel.
Yeah. And what made you make the book about the chaperone and not about Louise?
Well, I didn't want to write, you know, a book about a real person. And I don't know, as fascinating as I find Louise, I think she's a really interesting person with an interesting life story. But I didn't want to spend, you know, 300 pages in her head.
Right.
That wouldn't have been where I want to be. And I didn't know if that's where a reader wanted to be, because it was a really, it sounded like it was usually a pretty hard place to be.
Right.
And I wanted somebody a little bit softer, I guess with a more subtle landscape to her.
Right.
To act as the narrator and guide through this. And then I also liked the idea of making myself stick to the facts of Louise's life. So everything about Louise's life is true. And then having total freedom to imagine this other person.
Yeah, I think it works. It works
oh,
well.
Oh, great.
Because Cora.
Kind of cool. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say Cora's like a conduit to her,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's about seeing her from, from Cora's perspective entirely.
Yeah, and then also just Cora goes through so much. And I just relate to Cora more as a person,
yeah.
as a writer. She's an easier person for me to access and understand, even
yeah.
though I do strive to understand Louise, but I'm more like Cora. And so it wasn't until I saw that there was this older chaperone, that's who I felt immediate sympathy for, you know?
Right.
Poor woman having to go with this beautiful, bratty, intelligent teenager. What a nightmare.
Yeah, who had been through so much.
Who had been through so much herself, yeah.
Well, I thought in Cora, you really created a multi-layered person. She was much more complex, because at first, as the reader, you see her and you think, well, she's just a woman of her time, very conservative, and leads like a typical small town life and everything. But then, little by little, you find out that she's she's anything but.
Yeah.
That she's a much stronger woman than she appears to be, and has to deal with a lot more. And dealing with Louise is probably the least of her worries she's had in her life. You know, it was more of a big, it was a big adventure for her, a time to get away and see new things and be exposed to new things, you know, even though it was kind of not the best gig in the world, so to speak, since Louise was every difficult teenager rolled into one, even for that time.
She really is sort of the ultimate teenager, you know, just having everything that could bring out, I think, difficult times for Cora, or a real challenge for Cora. But it ends up being, as you said, really good for her, the adventure of it.
I mean, especially in 1922, her to have gone through all the things she's gone through. And then I really liked, because there were times, I'll admit, while I was reading, and it would go back to Cora's life, and I would be disappointed. I'd be like, oh, you know, I don't want to go back to her life. I want to get back to what's going on in New York. But then it worked out, because as you learned what had happened in her marriage, when, mm-hmm. you know, when that was revealed, I thought, that really tied me, you know, drew me into her. Yeah, it was like, oh my God, you know? So when you meet her, when the book first opens, you realize, oh my goodness, this is, you know, this is who she was. This is what had happened. And she was just kind of quietly living with it. So it made her very, very interesting.
Yeah. You know, I'm so interested in characters like that who are more interesting and more burdened and more complex than what they seem. Yes, on the front, I've learned this with my students. You know, I learned just to not make assumptions about them and think, you know, oh, this one's grown up in suburbia without ever having any problems.
Right.
And then, you know, you get to know them, or they write something and you think, oh, wow. You know, sometimes that's exactly what they are, but oftentimes, you know, even suburbia has its deep surprises, as this novel shows.
Yeah.
And people are more complex and more experienced with trouble than they might let on. And I wanted someone, you know, when I was creating this life for Cora, I thought about the real Louise Brooks only had this to say about her chaperone in her memoirs, the real chaperone. She said the real chaperone's name was Alice Mills, mm-hmm. but I changed her name because I didn't want to be, you know, have to think about the real person. I wanted the freedom to completely invent and imagine this character.
Right.
So I changed her name to Cora Carlisle. But one thing Louise said about her chaperone, she said, I tolerated Miss Mills' provincialism because we shared a love of theater, you know? It's such a Louise thing to say. It's so condescending, you know, even as an old woman, she kind of had that teenager, you know, I tolerated her provincialism. And I thought, I want to make her so much more complex than even Louise ever guessed.
I think you succeeded.
Thank you. Thank you.
I mean, that was very interesting with the orphan trains. I learned a lot reading this book, a lot of things I didn't know, because I'd never heard of the orphan trains. And, you know, a lot of the things they experienced when they did go to New York, some of that history, very well written.
Thank you so much. Thank you. You know, it was interesting with the orphan train. I had to come up with a reason that Cora would even be motivated to chaperone Louise.
Right.
Because, you know, now I would think, even now, if someone said to me, if, you know, if my child was gone to college and someone said, hey, if you watch my 15-year-old in New York, you'll have all expenses paid in Manhattan for 5 weeks. I might do it, even if I knew that this girl was going to be a little bit wild and a little bit of a challenge, just because it would be so fun to go to New York for 5 weeks, right?
Right.
But what I learned when I was researching is that is not how the rest of America really looked at New York. It was certainly not a vacation destination. It was sort of seen as this wild, scary, foreign place with really different social mores than the rest of the country, and especially in 1922 when everything was changing so fast. But there was no unifying cultural experience. Like, you know, of course, there wasn't any TV yet, and there really wasn't even radio yet.
Yeah.
You know, the radio was Wichita got its very first radio station in 1922, and it was still broadcasting, you know, market reports and like pig market prices and things. So that wouldn't have helped her understand what was happening in New York at all. And it would have seemed like a scary, wild place to her. Dirty, scary, you know, things, you know, tenement squalor is what she would have heard of. And also a lot more unrest about the prohibition of alcohol than she was used to coming from the driest state in the nation.
Right.
So, I wanted her to have a reason to go. And so that's when the orphan train stuff came up.
Yeah, it was perfect. And then, you know, I was really, really riveted by her meeting with her birth mother. And I thought it was, you know, even though you want a happier ending, I thought it was so honest that, you know, your birth mom, you know, she, you know, the time they lived in, yes. But at the same time, you would think she would even try to hide and communicate with her daughter. But she didn't even want that. She was just like, you know, I just came to, it was all about her, Burke's mother, Mary Odell. She was all about herself. That's what came through to me. She was a very selfish woman because she just wanted to, you know, like pacify her own curiosity about that baby she had given up. But she didn't care anything about Cora's feelings at all. That's how she came across.
Maybe. And, you know, the first time I wrote that scene, I was pretty hard on her, you know, and I did see her as sort of a villainous character. But as I rewrote and I thought about it, I mean, I would say I don't know what else she could have done. There really wasn't. She kind of had to come across that way because if Cora ever, she didn't know Cora. She didn't know what she was going to, you know, meet there at the train station. And if Cora were the kind of person who ever came up to Haverhill, Massachusetts, and cause problems, her entire family would be ruined, just absolutely ruined. And so she was taking this huge risk in satisfying her own curiosity, but she had to come across as a little bit scary and very much make clear that this is it. We are not going to keep in contact. And even though it might, I think it's one of those things where, of course, it would be incredibly selfish in this day and age, but there really wasn't much else she could have done without putting her entire family in absolute jeopardy. Like, there would have been no forgiveness. They would have been completely ostracized by the town. And, you know, and as she said, her other children were in politics. And so she was taking this huge risk, and I don't know what else she could have done. And she is very much a survivor. You know, she's the one who concocted that wild plan about how to deal with her pregnancy. And, you know, she's gotten this far. It was interesting to think like that there really wasn't anything else she could have done.
Well, yeah, I could see it's in this day and age, it does seem like she was a little bit harsh, but things were different then. And, you know, things were more, there's more stigma. And I think we'd even said like not that long ago, back in the 60s or so, people sent the unwed mothers off to homes and everything. You couldn't go to school, you know, and be pregnant. You were, you know, ostracized even back then. So, and as we're saying, Mary's whole life would have been turned upside down at that point in time. So she just couldn't afford that to do that to her, you know, current family. It was probably even brave of her to go to meet Cora in the first place because she didn't know what to expect. And I think in a way it kind of helped with her guilt that she'd had to give the child away. But and she just wanted to make sure she turned out okay, because as in your earlier part of the story, when they first talked about the orphan trains, that not everybody was as fortunate as Cora. A lot of people ended up in some pretty harsh situations. And I'm sure that in your research, you saw that that was the case. Everybody wasn't as fortunate as Cora was.
Yes, I definitely saw that. The Orphan Train Museum is here in Kansas because so many of the writers ended up here. It's way out west in Concordia, Kansas. But, you know, you can get on Netflix, you know, the documentaries from A&E and from the History Channel. And they're pretty moving, but they're also completely emotionally bewildering, because there was this big movement to interview as many survivors as they could before they died. So it's sort of like the Shoah Project. And you know, some people have, you know, really, really lucky situations like Cora, and they met for the first time. They had a family that loved and cared for them and wanted to educate them. And then I'd say most of them, you know, got somewhere in between where they were just field hands, you know, just hired labor, but not even free labor. I'm sorry, you know, especially the boys. And then of course you had a big segment that they were terribly abused and terribly mistreated, and they had absolutely no rights and no way to defend themselves. And it's horrifying. Horrifying.
Was Millennia said, I had never even heard about this. It's not something they taught you in U.S. history when you're in school. So I'll have to go back and look into it more.
Yeah, isn't that strange? You think they could make it so much more interesting. You know, people get it here. Like if I give a reading in the Midwest, people not only have read about it in school, but they usually have a grandparent or a great-grandparent who either rode the train or knew someone who had ridden the train, because it's such a part of the demographic here. I mean, 200,000 kids, that was a lot.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I'd consider Mary harsh, but okay. I still consider her selfish because, you know, you have that contrasted with what Cora and Alan decided to do with their situation, just lie to hide and cover up the truth, what was really going on. And I think that a mother, you know, I mean, even in those times, if she were a different woman, you know, who met her daughter. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go, you meet her. Yeah. You see that she checks out, you know, or she appears to, that you would want to maintain communication. She has children. You know what I mean? You could lie. You could say she's a long lost niece or she's a friend's child. Yeah. Or I mean, she could have found a way to keep her daughter, her firstborn daughter, in her life. And I don't, you know, I understood that she wasn't the type of woman who would do that. But I found her very selfish in that sense. So,
you know, you're right in that it is that meeting. That is at least some of what propels Cora to take the enormous leap she does with the way she's living back, because she sees what she doesn't want to turn into is someone so cowed by the social standards of the day that she can't make the true morally right decision.
But follow your heart. Yeah.
Right. Follow your heart. And then it's okay to lie. But you know, it's so interesting because I see what Cora did at the end as completely heroic and brave. But you know, I did have one person at a reading get really angry. And she said, and other people have had this responses. Well, she's living a lie. She's lying. And I don't see how that's moral. And they really believe that she's doing the wrong thing at the end because she's lying, you know, and I don't see that at all because I see it as this brave choice to live the way she could. And, you know, if someone were to say, oh, well, she could have come out and been honest, I think that's just not understanding how strong those social pressures were back then. You know, Alan would have been killed.
Yeah, it's not practical. It's not practical. Yeah.
But then I think it's totally fine for her, as you say, you know, sometimes you lie. She's not hurting anyone. None of them hurt anyone. And they just continued to live the way they wanted to, but they did it quietly.
Yeah. And she decided, you know, not to out Alan because she knew what would happen.
Yeah.
So she decided, you know what, I'm not going to make, you know, go down that road and take us down that road. He's the father of my children. And whatever. So she was just kind of dealing with it. And then, you know, this whole opportunity comes about for her to go to New York, and she decides that she's going to look up her birth history. Mm-hmm. And boom, she meets
Joseph.
And, you know, something wonderful happens there. And it's just, it's understandable that they made the choices they could so that they could live their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And I do think you're right that Cora is heroic in a way that Mary O'Dell isn't. And seeing kind of what Mary O'Dell is, I think, is a real cautionary tale for Cora.
Oh, absolutely.
Cora does. She does what she can to live the right way. Yeah.
And she never tells the kids. And was it Alan who wanted to tell them?
It was it was Joseph. Joseph thought maybe they should tell Greta the truth.
And she's like, no. Why would we do that?
And at first, you know, when I was first writing it, I thought there was going to be a scene where they finally tell Greta the truth. But I realized, you know, as I was writing and talking to people in my writing group, you know, we share drafts and we talk about things, but that was sort of putting present day morals and present day reasons and thinking onto the past, because now I can see why you might tell Greta because of medical history and that kind of thing. But back then, there was just no good reason to tell her. And if anything that Cora learned, you know, throughout this experience is that, you know, blood isn't really necessarily that thick. It doesn't really need to be. It doesn't matter. You know, for all intents and purposes, she is Greta's aunt. Right. And really, there is no truth that Greta needs to know, at least not at that time. There was no, you know, we have such an emphasis in our culture and time about telling the truth and coming out with what's honest. But back then, there was just no need.
And yet they did do it because she and Alan ended up having a very honest relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they become great friends.
Great friends. And she and his lover, I forget his name now.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, there was a whole lot of truth in the way they were living under this big cloud of, you know, of a lie.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, for their own protection. I totally understand it. I can understand how, you know, people who feel, you know, really strongly about morals, but it's just not practical, I think.
Right. Especially at that time. I mean, her choices would have been to either expose herself to jail or to ridicule, and her children to ridicule, and Alan to maybe murder.
Yeah.
Or to be unhappy for the rest of her life and live in this really sad, empty life, you know, to make everyone else happy. So she chose this third way that I thought was pretty great for her, you know?
Yes.
And then, you know, she does what she can within that within that system, you know, to shake things up as much as she can, you know, so mm-hmm. she isn't just lying, but, you know, she does things with Kindness House, with the Home for Unwed Mothers, mm-hmm. with birth control, you know, to make things a little better for the next generation. So she's sort of this quiet agitator.
Pioneer. Yeah. She's a pioneer. What came to my mind with her at the end of the book was, you know, from Titanic, when Rose, that line where she says, "A woman's heart is a deep ocean of secrets."
Yeah.
That's what I get from Cora. Because, you know, it's like, yeah, this elderly woman now, and oh boy, if they really knew.
Right. She took it all with her.
Exactly.
Well, and it may, you know, it wouldn't have served any purpose for her sons to know the whole truth. It just would have ended up hurting them and, you know, their futures too.
Yeah. And Alan had asked her not to, so she couldn't. You know, it was really his decision. He'd asked her not to. Yeah.
Right. Because, well, and it made sense because, you know, mm-hmm. they loved him and they didn't need to think any differently of him than he'd been a really good father, you know, and he loved them.
Yeah.
And then her last meeting with Louise.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of wondered, you know, why bother? It's like she was kind of there licking her wounds, Louise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she goes and she gives her a kick in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how I felt.
Yeah. And then, you know, she leaves and it's like the way she never showed her any
gratitude.
You know, yeah. Or just, I mean, and I get it. It's in keeping with her character and everything, but I just wish that their relationship had been a little more tender. Like, I wish Louise had warmed to her a little bit more, you know?
I think the people who knew Louise probably wish she would have been a little bit more tender.
Yes. You know?
It wouldn't have been true to her to do it any other way. This long story between Louise and her kinder brother, Teddy, mm-hmm. is just heartbreaking because it's really a story of him reaching out with compassion to her over and over and over again. And her kind of creeping up to it and then rejecting it right. over and over again. And it was just her way. She just wasn't a tender person. And she never really was. I mean, she did conquer her alcoholism at the end of her life, you know. And so she did grow and change. And she started writing. And she always was so intelligent. Mm-hmm. But maybe because of the trauma of what had happened to her when she was young, or maybe just in her DNA, she was never going to be a soft person to anyone.
Well, yeah, I mean, being molested at such a young age and then having the type of mother that she had, I
right.
think the cards were right there, you know, mm-hmm. that defined her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she'd built a really hard shell around herself and she wasn't going to let anybody in. So she had to, you know, be tough and be that way to prevent getting really hurt again. That was my take on it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a big deal that she would even write thank you on that card, you know?
Yeah.
That was huge for her. Although there is this one wonderful story about her that I couldn't include in the book because it just didn't work with the point of view. But this is sort of nice to think about Louise is that summer that she came back to Wichita and she was drunk and miserable and penniless and humiliated. Mm-hmm. That same summer, her older brother that she didn't get along with got a divorce and he had a 10-year-old son named Robert. And Robert was sent to go live with the grandparents as well. So can you imagine this poor kid? He's 10 years old in 1942. His parents have gotten a divorce, which is so stigmatizing.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to live with his crazy distant grandparents in this huge spooky house. And then his drunken post-starlet aunt Louise is stumbling around in the attic. And, yeah, you know, and he had dyslexia, which at the time, you know, they called stupid. And so he couldn't read. He'd been told he was stupid his whole life. Well, Louise found out about this and she was drinking pretty heavily, but she loved to read and she couldn't stand the fact that her nephew couldn't read or wouldn't read. And so she worked with him every day, not in the kindest way, but she worked with him and worked with him and taught him to read and taught him a system where he could read and enjoy books. And he went on to do very well for himself. And in fact, he died just recently and had a long career as a judge in Wichita. But when Louise was, you know, living in Rochester toward the end of her life and she was an old woman and someone was interviewing her because she'd had all these affairs with famous men. You know, she'd had Charlie Chaplin and then the founder of CBS, George Paley, the guy that owned the Redskins. She had all these like famous relationships with really powerful men. And they said, Louise, you know, who was the love of your life? And she said, well, I never really loved any of them. I've never been in love. And then she paused and she said, well, one. And she said, Robert Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
which is pretty sweet, you know, to think of those two, that scared little boy and this, as you said, very, very shell-wrapped woman. And, you know, who's to get out of way.
I don't know. I think you could have included that. I think that would have warmed her up if she was in that house teaching this little boy how to read. I mean, that
Yeah, Cora wouldn't have known all that. Cora wouldn't know. But she did some terrible things too. You know, she did some horrific things in her life that I didn't include because it was outside of Cora's experience.
Yeah.
She did some pretty terrible things. She was not, she was a beautiful woman, but for most of her life, she was not a nice woman and she was definitely not a tender woman.
Wow. So let's talk about your research. In doing your research, did you speak to any of her relatives or anything like that?
You know, I didn't speak to them while I was writing the book, but when I went and did my reading in Wichita, Rosie Brooks came to the reading, and that is her niece. So that is Louisa's really nice brother's daughter.
Okay.
And so she's in her, you know, she looks like she's maybe in her late 50s or late 60s now. Mm-hmm. And she you know, kind of looks like Louise. You can tell she's a Brooks, and she kind of has that mischievous, highly intelligent, but like also like, oh my God, what are you going to say in public kind of personality, you know? Like she sort of says things as they occur to her, and she's witty but brazen, and yeah. And she said she liked the book, and she said she felt like the depiction of Myra, which was Rosie's grandmother, was fair.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Because she felt like it was, you know, sympathetic enough, and that Myra, if there is a villain in the book, it's Myra.
Yes.
Lucy's mother. But, you know, even Myra had a pretty terrible life. Myra didn't want to be a mother. She didn't want to be a mother, and no one gave her any choice. And she didn't have the personality to be a mother. And she was just as beautiful and as talented and as artistically inclined as Louise, but none of that was offered to her. And so she was very bad at a job that she never asked for. Wow. So, you know, it's sad for her, but then also, you know, she could have, as like as Cora, she could have risen. She could have made lemonades with lemons.
She could have. A lot of women do.
Yeah, but then not everybody is heroic, you know.
Exactly.
And so I haven't had to live Myra Brooks' life.
Yeah.
And so Rosie felt like that was fair. And she had some, you know, she had some stories to tell about Louise. She said that when she was a little girl and living in Kansas, that with her father Teddy, that's when Louise was living in New York and was drunk and was falling off bar stools, you know, and had grown her hair down to her waist. And the phone rang one night, and it was her Aunt Louise, and she was drunk and saying, "Nobody loves me," and crying, "No one's ever loved me." And as a little girl would do, she said, "I love you, Aunt Louise." And that apparently rubbed Louise the wrong way, and she, you know, just unleashed this fury on this little girl through the phone that really terrified her. And then when her father came home, you know, she told her, and she said that the father's take on it was that he tried to teach Rosie was, this would not be okay normally, that this is a sick person. She's unwell. My sister is unwell. And that's how we have to treat her, as someone who is sick and sad. Yeah. But he never stopped trying to reach out to her. He never stopped.
So was The Chaperone your first title for the book?
Yeah. Right from the beginning. I knew I wanted to call it that.
Yeah.
I liked all the layers of it, you know, and I don't know if that's something other people think about, but to me, you know, this idea of in lieu of parents, you know, and there's so much of the book about taking care of someone who isn't your own child, right? So, you know, it's done for Cora. Cora then does it for Greta. Cora is a stand-in for Myra. And there's so many ways where you're sort of chaperoning someone else, even though it's not your responsibility.
Yeah. And so, are you writing anything now?
Well, I'm planning to. I teach at KU, and I don't get that much writing done when I'm teaching.
Right.
But I ruminate a lot. I think about things. And so I've got this idea, and I've done a lot of the research for it. And so I'll get next year off. And so come May, I'm going to jump into it with both feet. I might even try and write a couple chapters over Christmas break. But that's kind of how it works for me, is I think and learn while I'm teaching, you know,
right.
And then I jump into it when I have some time off.
And who are some of your favorite authors?
Oh, let's see. I really love Tobias Wolff.
Okay. Yeah.
I really love him. And I like Sue Miller and Grace Paley. I love Toni Morrison, Sandra Cisneros. I do like Juno Diaz. There's so many. Oh, I'm reading the new novel by Elizabeth Gilbert. Mm-hmm. I never read Eat, Pray, Love. I just, you know, I don't know. I'm one of the two people in the world who didn't read it, but I picked up her new novel, which is historical, and oh my gosh, it's amazing.
I didn't read Eat, Pray, Love, so me and you.
Okay, well, we're the two people. It's nice to meet you.
I think Roberta did.
I read it.
I love the Poisonwood Bible. You know, I usually have favorite books more than favorite authors.
Okay, yeah.
You know, because you don't love everything somebody does.
Right.
Unless they're Sue Miller, and then I pretty much love everything she does.
Well, I love The Chaperone.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. I was just in a fever when I wrote it. You know, I had a semester off, and so I researched like crazy. I just felt like I was inhaling the 1920s silent film, Orphan Trains, and Louise Brooks. There were books everywhere. It's all I talked about. It was all I thought about. My daughter was 6 at the time, and at one point she looks up at me and she was crying. She was angry about something, and she pointed at me and said, "And no more talking about Louise Brooks." Because it was pretty crazy around here for a while. You know, when I get going, I get really going.
Yeah, you immersed yourself in it, and you really brought it to life. I really felt I was there in 1922 and on.
Thank you very much. Thank you. What are you all reading next?
Next, we're reading But Inside I'm Screaming by Elizabeth Flock. I think it's a young adult novel. But yeah, so the way we pick our books is we do a quiz. Like today, we're having the quiz on your book, on The Chaperone. And whoever wins gets to pick the next book. And we pick like four months in advance. So
what a wonderful idea. Yeah. I've never heard of that, but that's fantastic.
It's fun.
That's great. I wonder if I could pass the quiz. I don't know.
Roberta can send it to you. She's the one who did it.
That's great. I loved it. Yeah, that'd be nice.
So yeah, we have fun.
Yeah, we do. We do.
That's great. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. I've never encountered a book club like that, you know, that's online and you're spanning the globe. That's really cool.
Yeah, we've been going since 2000.
Oh, good for you.
Mm-hmm. So do you have anything else you'd like to share with the group?
No, just, you know, my complete gratitude for, you know, reading my book and then just, you know, being people that care about books in general. It's just a small army of us out there, you know, it's a tribe, and it's always nice to meet people who are in it too. So thank you.
This was, I forgot to say this at the beginning, but The Chaperone was chosen by Nicole, who lives in Texas.
Oh,
so yeah.
Thanks, Nicole.
And the one question I had for you, last question, what was the most memorable thing that you learned while you were researching her life and this time period and stuff?
Well, you know, one thing that I had to put in the book, because I read it and I thought, I can't believe it's true. And it's one of those things that if you made it up, no one would believe you. But toward the end of the book, they go to a baseball game, and it was in Wichita in the late 20s. And the Ku Klux Klan's baseball team really did play the first African-American team in Wichita.
Wow.
And it really was umpired by Catholics because they felt that everyone would hate everyone equally. Mm-hmm. And the Marbones, the African-American team, really did win.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just one of those things that you think, God, that happened, you know, that was a baseball game. And, you know, it's one of those things that if you made it up, it would seem like so strange and unbelievable, but that happened. And that really stunned me. It did. And I had to get that in somehow, you know, because
Yeah, if it wasn't something that actually happened, you would think, no, they would have lynched somebody.
Yeah.
They beat them,
you know,
no,
they got
they
the Catholics.
And
the, you know,
house,
I mean,
you know?
It's just crazy, you know, it's crazy, but it did. You know, that, as you said, like, there's things we never learn in school about the human side of things that are so interesting. You know, if you think about them as stories or like people's lives that they really lived, it's, you know, I think so much life can be breathed into history.
Speaking of Cora and that, the part where she, you know, goes to the show on Broadway, the first African-American show, and, you know, she was freaking out, like, oh my God, what has she brought me to? And then, you know, it shows how it shaped her view later that, you know, she didn't, you know, when the civil rights stuff was going on, she had a different view of it because of that night, you know, when Louise brought her to that show.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking, like, some critic was saying, oh, it was too quick. You know, she never would have had a great time at that show if she would have gone in with her biases. But I feel like that's how things happen. You know, people are forced into situations where they're around people that they've been told to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. And then they see, you know, oh, you know, this is actually kind of interesting or fine, you know, or like it's good. It's, you know, and you're forced into it and you think, okay, this isn't so bad. And then you sort of tuck it away in your mind.
Well, she was primed. Yeah. And she was primed for it because, hey, she's in New York City. I mean, it's not, I think if it had happened in Wichita, maybe she would have got up and left, you know, she'd be like, what the hell?
And but, everybody else around her is acting like it's normal. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So you're the one who's now going to stick out like a sore thumb.
Right. Whereas in Wichita, everybody would have been scandalized, you know. Exactly. So now she's taken a little bit of New York home. And I think that's kind of how it works with social change. Just how people move around and they're exposed to new ideas little by little. And just one night like that can really make you think about things differently, you know. But she needed time to ruminate on it, like you say.
Yeah. So boo to that critic. He's mistaken.
I agree.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Laura. I've really enjoyed the book, and I've really enjoyed listening to your take of things.
Yeah,
thank you
too.
So much. Thank you. It was really nice to talk with both of you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. So that's going to be our discussion of The Chaperone. We want to thank our listeners for tuning in. And again, thanks to Laura for joining us. And as always, please continue to leave us your comments below and stay tuned for next month's episode. December, we'll be discussing But Inside I'm Screaming by Elizabeth Flock. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.